Welcome to yet another entry into the Narrated Trench Crusade lore series. I'm incredibly thankful for the positive feedback and comments. The narrated content and art is taken from official sources, sprinkled with my own creations, writing, and editing. If you enjoy this series, please don't forget to subscribe, like, and let me know your thoughts in the comments below. With that out the way, let's get started. The world is a broken testament to humanity's fall, its skies choked with ash, and its lands scarred by the ceaseless war between the faithful and the damned. A third of humanity has turned its back on the Creator, bending the knee to the idols of hell and swearing allegiance to the archdevils. From these forsaken masses rise the heretic legions, hell's mortal army on earth. A force of blasphemy and brutality forged in the fires of Inferno. These legions are not mere soldiers. They are the embodiment of humanity's corruption, their bodies branded with the marks of their infernal patrons and their souls bound to eternal servitude. They march under banners of defiance, their eyes fixed on the throne of heaven, which they seek to topple in their mad quest for parity with their Creator. From the charred ruins of once holy cities to the blood-soaked battlefields of the Great War, the heretic legions spread their dark gospel, their ranks bolstered by hell's own monstrous progeny and those mortals who have sacrificed their humanity for a taste of infernal power. Among these damned, the heretic naval raiders stand as a terrifying force upon the seas. Commanded by the ruthless high captains, they dominate the waves, striking with precision and savagery to enforce hell's dominion over the waters. Their raids are a testament to the heretic legion's unrelenting cruelty, a reminder that even the oceans are not beyond the reach of hell's grasp. The heretic fleet maintains naval supremacy on the majority of the seven seas. Only in the Mediterranean do the faithful strive to maintain some parity in order to ensure the supply of New Antioch. But elsewhere, the heretic naval raiders are an ever-present menace to shipping lanes and coastal communities. The power of the heretic fleet is threefold. First, there are the behemoth capital ships, built in mockery of the Ark that God once bade Noah to construct. These are enormous capital ships, floating cities that act as mobile bases for fast strike craft and the insidious submarines that prowl the shipping lanes and ambush military convoys. For land operations, the fleets employ their infamous naval raiding parties as marine infantry. Naval raiders' armor is modified to double as diving suits, allowing entire strike teams to infiltrate the shoreline batteries or harbor defenses undetected. The diving cylinders of the naval anointed hold oxygen mixed with unnatural fumes from the lake of fire, providing up to 66 hours of breathable gas and bestowing a high degree of resistance to decompression sickness. Thus they can stay submerged for extended periods of time, gathering large infantry strike forces undetected right at the enemy shores. The heretic naval raiders rarely have problems in finding fresh recruits. Several mighty nobles of hell lay claim over the seven seas, attracting many of their worshippers to the fleets. There is plentiful loot, as well as many chances for promotion and finding favor in the eyes of their infernal overlords through deeds of wanton murder, despoiling the places where saints once spread the faith of the tyrant god the heretics hate. A favorite tactic of the naval raiders is to sneak upon their target in the cover of night, striking at dawn in honor of the morning star. This serves the dual purpose of taking the enemies when they are at their most vulnerable, as well as a blasphemous ritual in honor of the throne that the infernal lords one day wish to erect on Mount Zaphon after toppling the seat of Yahweh. The raids typically start with a silent stealth assault. Any lookouts will have their throats ripped open by the Tartarus claws of the death commandos, while silent naval legionnaires emerge from beneath the waves, unleashing sudden death with poison gas grenades, silenced pistols, and boarding axes. Once the alarm is raised, a bombardment by specialized sea hags pound the target, throwing defenders into confusion and turmoil. This shock to the defenders is followed up by a charge of elite legionnaires, intoxicated by the fumes of their oxygen tanks. Often the naval raiders have crept close enough to their enemies that when the time to strike comes, there is no time to organize defenses. Lacking heavier troops or armored support, the naval raiders' combat doctrine relies on speed, surprise, and savagery. Fighting is to be undertaken at close quarters, favoring automatic weapons and penetrating any lines of defense, and engaging their enemies in brutal melee with boarding axes and short stabbing blades before a proper defensive line can be organized. Competition for prestige and the honor of inflicting the greatest amount of pain and destruction on the faithful lands is fierce. To provide proof of the success of their attacks and to strike fear in the hearts of their enemies, each high captain has their own unique way of declaring that they were behind the raid. For example, the 112th Sea Legion, known as the Virtue Breakers, dismembers its fallen enemies and uses Gotic rituals to return a necromantic semblance of life to quivering flesh, leaving crawling and twitching arms, legs, and screaming heads behind for the rescuers to discover. Meanwhile, the crew of the Serpent-class strike ship, Disciple of the Burning Water, prefers to drag their opponents overboard and then cut them with underwater welding torches. They take great pride by killing their prey in a manner where they die by drowning and burning simultaneously. Objectives of the heretic raids vary: slave raids, destruction of shore defenses or communities, gathering information, looting coastal enclaves, or escorting death commandos on missions to take out important church leaders or temporal rulers through assassination, just to name a few. What the faithful fear the most, however, are full-scale invasions within their heartlands, like the 1872 landing that conquered Rijeka and established a beachhead that is like a dagger pointed at the heart of the church. Thus, the sea patrols from the Gulf of Finland to the coastal guard of the Des Moines of France, and the Capudan Pasha's fleet sailing the Sea of Arabia nervously watch the waves, hoping that the waters off their home shores do not hide a heretic naval raiding party. But the age of the Great War is dark, and the sea belongs to the enemies of God. Countless battles of the Great War have been fought over sacred sites. A myriad of ruined temples, churches, shrines, and masjids litter no man's land, devastated by artillery, flames, and demolition charges. Graveyards and hastily dug military cemeteries are disturbed by shelling, and the boots of soldiers trample over these sites, unheeding of their original spiritual purpose. But the land remembers that which human memory does not. Over the long years of strife, many heretics have fallen in battle over hallowed ground, only to find that there is no escaping the Great War. The earth will not suffer their polluted bodies and souls, forcing them to lurch to their feet and back into the fray. Heaven is denied to them, nor can they be claimed by hell. Thus, a new trench ghost is born. These shades dimly remember their mortal lives, and their dead fingers grasp bolt-action rifles with torn gas masks placed over ruined faces. As the grave-cold commands of their long-dead officers echo across the battlefields, they gather into war bands that strike out to fight once more, since rest is now denied to them. The condition of the trench ghost fills them with bottomless hatred and envy for the living, and their warbands wage endless war against all other creatures, be they faithful or their former comrades who serve the Inferno. Even the poor wretches afflicted by the Black Grail are more alive than the ghosts, who would gladly exchange their cold misery for a chance to feel their pain. They attack all intruders to no man's land on sight, silently gathering into assault squads when they sense anything that does not share their miserable state. Though it no longer carries any true purpose, the trench ghosts still feel the greed for coin and the compulsion to arm and equip themselves. They loot no man's land for every buried ducat or discarded rifle and sword, and pile such loot into great hoards in hidden places. When there are no enemies to fight, they trade with each other and perform military drills, even though these actions have no meaning or end goal. These undead warbands recruit lone, wandering trench ghosts to their ranks, and they can swell into virtual ghost armies, holding sway over large tracts of land, shadowy domains where dead generals hold court as ghost kings. Even the seas are not safe from this undead plight, for those heretics who perished when fighting over sacred waters have become ghostly raiders, bound to the high seas until Judgment Day. When the sun is high in the sky, the ghosts haunt the bunkers, pillboxes and underground tunnels, waiting to ambush the unwary and foolish who venture into their lairs in search of respite. Their semi-corporeal forms, though extremely resistant, can still be destroyed by sword and bullet, and especially fire. Hacked to pieces, burned or blown apart by ordnance shells, even the undead form of a trench ghost will eventually cease its struggle, losing the will to animate its remains. But even this does not grant them release. Their sentience still lingers in the shattered remains, never able to escape the circle of Earth, eternally trapped between this world and the next. Years pass and their semi-corporeal remains wither into ugly black soot, where memories gnaw their tortured mind that has now lost all cohesion. Such living dust swirls around the battlefields of No Man's Land, and one can hear the ghostly wails of agony emanating from it. Soldiers who hear this eternal, unearthly echo of pain never forget it. The heretic forces lead the faithful in the arms race of tanks and other armored vehicles. They are heavily armored, fast-moving, and often armed with terrifying hell-forged sacrilege-type tank mortars. These weapons are designed to penetrate trenches, pillboxes, and other defensive structures by employing technology that briefly tears through reality to puncture the defenses. They target the occupants within using ammunition that unleashes echoes of the reversed words of God's creation, reverberating at bone-shattering volume throughout the structures under attack. Specifically designed to undo divine work, they peel away skin, nervous systems, and finally, the flesh and internal organs of any mortals, layer by layer for each word, as God's creation is undone, causing excruciating death as their target slowly becomes unmade. To counter these armored threats that have been used to break through their lines, the Prussians have developed many battlefield innovations, from anti-materiel rifles to specialist close-quarter guard corps units. As the sacrilege cannons are slow-firing and hard to aim, the Prussians counter them with lightning-fast close-quarters tactics. The swords of the guard corps, commonly called tank splitters, are specifically designed to disable or destroy enemy armored vehicles. Developed by the Prussian Institute of Metallurgy, their edges are orichalcum and titanium alloy, and these near monomolecular blades can cut through most vehicle tracks and armor with ease, disabling them while the rest of the unit swarms the tank with incendiary grenades. Speed is of essence here, as heretics are well aware of this tactic and counter such attacks with elite legionnaires of their own, who compete with each other in capturing rather than killing the specialist Stoßtruppen. so they can be sold to the agents of the Court of the Seven-Headed Serpent as punishment for their audacity. Though the Free State of Prussia is governed by an outlandish and ancient system called democracy, where each citizen can vote for representatives on the Landtag to decide state affairs, the nobility maintains a strong military tradition and has funds to buy officers' commission. Many families can trace their lineage back to the Teutonic Orders, who once conquered the lands of Prussia. Protected by semi-sentient barbed wire that wraps around those foolish enough to stray too close, the heretic trenches are a formidable obstacle for the faithful. The pyramid-shaped pillboxes and casemates of the infernal forces have turned back countless futile frontal assaults with withering machine gun fire and devastating hell-wrought artillery. Surprises are difficult to mount, especially when the moon waxes and the horrors created by the path of the beast prowl no man's land. The weapon of choice against these formidable obstacles in Duke Constantine's arsenal are the Stoßtruppen, the elite shock troops of the Free State of Prussia. Even in this nation, known for their militaristic ways, the Stoßtruppen are the elite, chosen from mountaineers and veterans of the fierce battles against the northern heretics, with the cream of the combat engineers and marksmen mixed in. They are called the Duke's Spear, for their speciality is to pierce the enemy lines and clear the path for the reserves. The training and selection process is ruthless. Athleticism is emphasized, as is the ability to rapidly advance over any kind of terrain. Just as important is to learn how to make use of both camouflage and even the tiniest bit of terrain for cover. They learn to hit their targets in total darkness and train wrestling with hulking communicants. But the most important selection criteria is to have iron in your soul. To engage with the armies of the damned in close quarters requires a certain kind of soldier, one who is willing to detonate their last grenade when their own innards have been ripped open by the claws of a werewolf, or wrestle a heretic anointed and look into their eyes, see the hellfires raging there, and not to flinch but bring their trench club down. As the Stoßtruppen gather for an attack, no sound is heard. Each assault has been carefully practiced, and any signs needed are given with hand signals. Heavy weapons of the unit open the assault, scattering the enemy and forcing them to take cover. Then, it is a mad dash across no man's land. Violence commences as the flamethrowers sweep the exposed enemy, followed by a flurry of grenades into trenches and dugouts. Then the assault groups spread out like the wings of an eagle, clearing the trenches, sweeping behind the enemy lines, and disabling lines of communication, as well as any rearguard defensive units. In close quarters, the Stoßtruppen favor daggers, trench clubs, entrenching tools, and automatic pistols, though their favorite weapon by far is the grenade, carried with them in great quantities, and used to take out strong points, as well as to reach behind loopholes and clearing entrances to bunkers and pillboxes. As for ranged weaponry, submachine guns and pistols are favored and feature many modifications compared to standard issue versions, typically with larger magazines, as the brutal close quarters combat depletes ammunition very rapidly. The Stoßtruppen uniforms reflect their role, featuring mountain boots, leather reinforced jackets and trousers that protect their vital areas against barbed wire and enemy blades. Their armor contains far higher quantities of orichalcum than those of standard foot sloggers. This allows for much lighter and more flexible suits and helmets, which offer superior protection. The famed spikes of their Pickelhauber helmets are detachable and are usually not worn in the front lines, as they make their wearers easy targets. Compared to many other faithful soldiers, the pride of the Free State's armed forces are allowed a great deal of freedom of decision-making on the battlefield. Many warbands are given high-level objectives and encouraged to find their own way to achieve them over days, weeks, and months. Only single-minded determination can carry the Prussian advances through the enemy lines. One must learn to love carnage and death, for in melee there is no room for mercy or hesitation. A Sturman, who survives for any length of time, begins to resemble their hell-twisted enemies more and more after each grueling encounter. Such is the price that the Great War extracts. Trench clerics who fight in the Great War include a vast array of both ordained and secular fighting ministers of the Holy Word. A good example of such are the specially trained Militärgeistliche that the Church Militant of the Free State of Prussia dispatches to counter the heretic legion's sorcerers and high priests who pit their faith against the fiendish Gothic powers of the Inferno. Due to the importance of their role, the Church and the Free State go to extraordinary lengths to train and equip their chaplains with the finest weapons and armor. In battle, these Prussian trench clerics don thrice blessed armor crafted in the sacrosanct workshops beneath Köln Cathedral. They are styled after the armors of a bygone age to inspire the troops, but their functionality is state of the art as they utilize the latest metallurgical innovations from the Königsberg Institute of Warfare. The location of the workshops is not without controversy, as both the Free State of Prussia and the Holy Roman Empire claims ownership of Köln. This dispute stems from the time when the Free State seceded from the Empire after holding its first democratic elections. These elections were originally instituted specifically to gain independence from the Empire, but proved immensely popular with the people and have remained in place ever since. Luckily for Prussia, the Church considers the war effort more important than petty regional squabbles, and has thus far placed the cathedral under their care in order to keep the war production going. The chaplain's superb armaments are not just limited to protection. They also carry special grenades filled with myrrh, hemlock, and burning incense, as well as classified chemical substances. When detonated, the shrapnel of these grenades scatters embers that rapidly burn through anything caught in the blast. The standard issue melee weapons of the Feldkaplan are swords. Sometimes they are blades fashioned after the burning blade carried by the angel that protected the Garden of Eden, while others are smaller copies of the mighty brands carried by the paladins. Many frontline chaplains are repeatedly reprimanded by the Church for their overuse of inhaling holy smoke, a chemical compound which uses many of the same ingredients as the martyrdom pills. But due to the extraordinary mental and physical toll the war takes on their minds and bodies, the practice persists even though many chaplains are lost to overdosage or have to be retired from active service. With time, their minds and bodies succumb to the combination of stress, wounds, and the nervous system damage caused by holy smoke. The Great Hospice of New Antioch treats hundreds of such cases each year, men who have become a withered husk of their old selves. The Red Brigade is a force forged in grief and bound by vengeance, a brotherhood of soldiers who have lost everything to the ravages of the Great War. Founded by St. Ernest, the sole survivor of the Second Battle of Acre, the brigade is a testament to the enduring pain of those left behind. Clad in blood-stained armor and driven by a singular purpose, these grim warriors undertake the most perilous missions. Their lives are sacrificed to the memory of the fallen. They are the Duke of New Antioch's chosen blade, striking deep behind enemy lines to sever supply routes, assassinate high-value targets, and sow chaos among the ranks of the damned. Yet even among these haunted soldiers, there are those whose sorrow transcends the mortal realm. The Crimson Communicants, born of the Mendelist Order's arcane rituals, are a rare and tragic breed. These towering figures, shaped by loss and sacrifice, stand as both guardians and avengers for the Red Brigade. Their presence on the battlefield is a grim reminder of the cost of war and the unbreakable bonds forged in the fires of grief. The communicant creation process is anything but stable. Though the Mendalist Order continually experiments to perfect the chemical formulas, the personality and history of the volunteers who undergo the ritual has just as great an impact on how stable and functional the communicant that emerges from the communion chamber will be. Only one in three of the communicants are deemed fit to serve the church militant. Others have some fatal flaw, or mental or physical deformity, that renders them unfit to be released into the world. There are countless of such imperfections. Some are consumed by rage they cannot control, or become catatonic automatons. Others emerge with minds that are childlike and incapable of violence. Quite commonly, a failed communicant is gripped with such an existential dread of their condition that they simply curl into balls of twisted muscle and sinew, screaming and sobbing their anguish in the echoing halls of the Mendalist monasteries. Many of such failed communicants are immured in tombs that know no sound, there to waste away their agonizing years in torment, away from the prying eyes that might incur criticism of the hard-working Mendalist Brotherhood. Yet in some cases, the abbot of the Laboratory Monastery sends a quiet word to New Antioch that a crimson communicant has emerged. Soon, an officer of the Red Brigade is sent to extend an invitation to the giant to join the blood pledges. The crimson communicants are created from volunteers who have lost a loved one, and now, with their senses heightened by the Mendalist arts, they experience extraordinary levels of grief and guilt. Though unresponsive to any other stimuli, they feel an instinctive and extraordinary strong connection with the soldiers of the Red Brigade. They follow the brigade on their doomed missions, as loyal as their hounds, and carry bronze bells that toll over the no man's land. In combat, they attack anyone who threatens one of the brigade with startling rage and ferocity. They wear helmets to hide their faces, which they shun to reveal, and fight using great mauls to pulverize heretics or other foes of the brigade. After each battle, they pick up crushed bodies of their enemies and carry them everywhere they go, naming them after the people they lost in their previous life as humans, like gruesome and morbid dolls of a grieving child. As a parting gift, when leaving the Mendalist Monastery, they are each gifted by the Atonement Bell. Crimson Communicant can channel the sorrow of the second Metachrist through the sound of the bell. Its mournful sound resonates on spiritual as well as physical level, causing all who hear it flee in despair. From the night of fire and blood and poisoned bullets that laid low the monastery of Velerad in Greater Moravia, emerged a single monk of the Orthodox Order of Saint Methodius. Though the rest of the Brotherhood perished in the catastrophe as an elite death commando squadron made its audacious raid, the sole survivor brought with him the books of the saint and his Orthodox faith out of the utter ruin. With the loss of the workshops and monastic libraries of Velerad, it was believed that the secrets of the anchorite construction were lost, and the church no longer wished to pursue their construction due to advances in armor technology elsewhere. But this was in error. The monk named Brother Akakios still knew the craft. Akakios fled to the Theocratia of Hellas and founded a new monastery on the slopes of holy Mount Athos. Many monks lived in the monastic communities on the slopes of the mountain, and some were attracted to join Brother Akakios. Thus, Akakios became the first war prophet of the order, and many lay members joined or became supporters, and eventually the foot soldiers of the well-equipped and disciplined war pilgrimages of Saint Methodius. In their fortified monastery, the learned monks hoard the knowledge and the audacity of modifying the sacred designs of Saint Methodius. Their shrine anchorites are without a peer and feature many modern weapons and adjustments which allow them to carry modern long-range weaponry. No other warband has such an abundant access to anchorites or the variety of sophisticated weaponry and equipment. Following the ancient Orthodox creed, the pilgrims of St. Methodius reject many of the teachings and customs of other pilgrim processions. They consider the creation of the communicants as a dangerous heresy and condemn the use of martyrdom devices as an affront to God's commandment against suicide, as well as holding to other beliefs many of the trench pilgrims view as an essential part of their crusade against the forces of Inferno. Bitter schisms and arguments with other sects sometimes erupt into violence, and the Church itself accuses the order of clinging to the outdated Eastern Orthodox faith. However, due to their formidable fortress monasteries upon Mount Athos and their undeniable zeal on the battlefield, the princes of the Church turn a blind eye to the affairs of the followers of St. Methodius, as long as they focus all their zeal in the seemingly impossible task of relieving the city of Trebizond of the long-lost theme of Chaldea. Here, according to the visions of Prophet Akakios, the unsullied faith is still practiced and the salvation of mankind will be achieved. To this end, the order sends one war pilgrimage after another to the front line. Not one has made it within sight of the fabled walls of Trebizond, but this only increases the zeal of the order and rouses them into ever greater efforts to reach the city of the hill. Mamluks are an echo of a bygone age, last members of the warrior elite that once ruled a great empire in northern Africa. They suffered grievous losses at the earliest stages of the Great War, when the legions of demons Alambua emerged from the Hellgate. The Fatimids led their Mamluk forces in a desperate campaign to reclaim Levant, but of their fate there is no tale. Instead of returning victorious warriors, the slaves of Jahannam rushed through Sinia like an evil wind, razing Alexandria and Cairo to the ground. The remaining Mamluks fought bitterly to protect their homes, but to no avail. Too proud to leave their ancestral homes at the mercy of evil, some of the last Mamluks did not heed the call to migrate beyond the Iron Wall, and instead dispersed throughout the lands they once ruled to fight on. A fight that has never ceased since those dark days. To this day, the Mamluk knights play a deadly game of ambush and sudden raid on the Egyptian front against Mamun's legions, making their living as swords for hire, waging an endless war against the heretics and composing poets of lamentation in memory of their lost and devastated homelands. Generations of war have hardened the Mamluks into peerless warriors. For parents pass on the secrets of Furusia, the martial skills and ethical conduct of the Arabian Nights to their children. Too few in numbers to wage open war, the Mamluks instead fight alongside any of the peoples of the book, making their living by offering their swords to a highest bidder. As long as such a leader promises to fight the forces of Shaitan, they respect noble character and martial prowess above all, and often bond by sharing their way of the sword with an ally they respect. Only a few of the famed artificial heavy war horses of the Mamluks remain, and they are not risked in open combat unless they are used directly to defend the last few hidden abodes the Mamluks still inhabit in the vast deserts that stretch beyond the Nile Delta. However, these tireless steeds are used to take the heavy Mamluk warriors into advanced positions where they can disrupt the enemy plans and surprise exposed enemy units. That brings us to the end of this episode. If you are still listening, thank you. As I said, your positive feedback and comments keep me going. You can support my content by checking out my Ko-fi page or by subscribing to my free newsletter, both linked in the description. I sincerely hope you enjoyed this video, and I wish you a good day or a good night.